You will all turn to in your Bibles to Psalm 8. Pardon me, I had a coughing fit there. Now, Steve told you that we're switching services today, and he asked me if that'd be okay, and I said that was fine with me. And so, once again, I thought it best to postpone continuing our study of the book of Hebrews, or the letter of Hebrews, until next Sunday night. Now, I thought, and I had been preparing for that, so all of a sudden, I didn't know what in the world I was going to teach on. So I thought I'd get out one of my notebooks and see if there was anything in there that I might share with you. Now, do you all have a note? Anybody have a notebook or a journal? Do you? Mark's raising his hand, and Olivette does? Oh, good. In something like that, you could keep records of the Lord's dealings with you. I hope you keep a journal. If you don't, just a couple little hints. You don't have to write every day. That can be burdensome. And I'll just tell you this. I found myself, I most often write in my journal when I'm feeling a little bit down. I don't know why that is. Maybe I'm sitting there before God and thinking, Lord, well, you know, I'm complaining to him in my journal. But often God responds and I'll write in there, God helped me. So I hope you keep a journal. I'll just let you know, here's mine. This is my current one. It has Mount Vernon on the front. So the book doesn't have to be special. And by the way, this is George Washington's house. And then he expanded it, and then he expanded it even more. I don't know why I have this book. Someone gave it to me. And this is Liv's journal. Now, that's pretty. It's not so old, ugly thing. And she writes in it often, don't you? Yeah, she's going, yes, she does. And this is my first journal. I began in 1983. That was a long time ago. And I was a different human being when I wrote in it. It's interesting too. But I just tell you kids, write in your journal. Write your thoughts down and write them in some sense as if God's listening. So I found something. Psalm 8 is our text. In my journal, I have just a list. See, you'd do anything in your journal. I have a list of rhetorical questions that I have found in the Bible. Now, why in the world I started that list, I don't know. Now, a rhetorical questions are questions that a person might ask not in order to gain an answer from his listeners, but rather to make a point to his listeners. The sky is blue might be is the sky blue? Well, of course it is. That's a way of making a statement. Marriage is a great institution, but who wants to live in an institution? Y'all heard that one? It's a little rhetorical question. Do pilots take crash courses? It's a little humorous rhetorical question. If you prick us, and I'm going to ask you where this came from, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? Now, who said, where is this from? Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice. what's the merchant's name? Shylock. And there in that story, he is responding to someone being mean to him as a Jew. And he says, if we're just like everybody else, you prick us. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tell us a funny story, we laugh. It's a rhetorical question. Some questions are just funny. Others make profound statements. I'm going to get this off. Well, I sure want to read you something on this. Boy, it's good. Liebest says I can. No? She says, I'm going to do it anyway. This is just on the cover. Difficulty is behind. Fear is before. Though he's got on the hill, the lions roar. A Christian man is never long at ease. When one fight's over, another doth him seize. John Bunyan. Good, you know, wow, that's good. So keep a journal of your dealings with God and how God speaks with you. Okay. That's my little advice to the young people here, but not just the young people, everybody. So Kilseth and Olivet, I'm talking to y'all, keep a prayer journal. She won't even look at me. She's like, Olivet, she's got one. Good. You folks over there, you Scots. Okay. So, the rhetorical question we'll be looking at tonight, or this morning, is what is man that thou dost take thought of him? The son of man that thou dost care for him? It's a rhetorical question. Before we get to that, let's just notice a few things in this psalm that will give our rhetorical question some context. First, notice that David, our hymn writer, has been pondering the night sky. Verse 1, O Lord, how majestic is thy name in the earth. Thou hast displayed thy splendor above the heavens. Now in verse 3, when I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon, the stars that thou hast ordained. He's been looking up in the night sky. Now this last week, the moon and the stars have just been beautiful. If you get up early, the moon has been setting in the west, and Mars is there, and there's constellations, and glory. I can only imagine what the stars would have looked like before streetlights and pollution. But the shepherd David was well aware of the glories of the night sky. Night and day, his father's sheep were under David's care. And I'm sure the night sky often filled his vision. Can you imagine in those days how clear it would have been, the Milky Way and the glory as he looked up into the sky? Sleeping out in the open with those sheep. But I'm thinking that his life as a shepherd is not what's being referenced here. I think troubles were the thing that had kept him up. For David had enemies. Remember way back when we were teaching about that King David? He complains about enemies. And if you follow God, you will have some. If you want to live for God, people may not like it. Often people don't like God, and they don't even like thinking about Him. So you may have enemies. So I'm thinking that it's possible that God's enemies were worrying David, and that's why he was up that night. One way or the other, David looks into the night sky, and here we find that his troubles have led him to God. The natural world will often lead us to God if we but acknowledge that this is our Father's world. Are we going to sing that? When's that, Steve? At the end? Good. I knew he was going to do it. I asked him to. Maltby Davenport Babcock wrote that wonderful hymn, "This is My Father's World." How often nature leads us to God. Babcock would often take walks out into the nature, out in nature, and he'd say to his wife, "I'm going to go take a walk and see some of my Father's world." I like that. "When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon, the stars which thou hast ordained. O Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth, thou who hast displayed thy splendor above the heavens." Now one day, I'd like to go see McDonald Observatory. Anybody been there? Oh, good, good. I'd like to see it. It's in the mountains of the Big Bend. Did you know what street McDonald's Observatory's on? Dark Sky Drive. I kind of like that. Dark Sky Drive. You could see. This is my point. In the dark skies of life, God's wonders are more clearly seen. In fact, if your troubles keep you up at night, you might as well just get up and go seek God. The devil will keep you asleep if you keep doing that. Now, dark skies are the things that will make his wonders more clearly seen. This psalm is a revelation cast against the backdrop of a dark night for David. And if you've come into a dark and troubling period in your life, look up. God's starry lights may become more clear in such times as we're looking for him. Now then David, with his eyes full of the glory of God, says something startling. It's just kind of like, doesn't seem to fit. This amazing creating God entrusts his glory to the weakest of things, children. Did David view the little kingdom that God had put in his charge as a kingdom of children? I think maybe. For from the mouths of infants and nursing babes, thou hast established strength because of thine adversaries, to make the enemy and the revengeful cease. David was dealing again, as often, with enemies of God. And this is all very much like that verse in 1 Corinthians that I'm so fond of quoting, and you're going to get tired of me. And when you do, complain to Steve and he'll put a stop to it. "For consider your calling, brethren, that there are not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things," you might even say here, children, "of the world to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame those things which are strong." What could be weaker than a little child? "The base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, that he might nullify the things that are. Now, some translators with verse 2 say that the praise of children in God's economy becomes an offensive, now listen, and defensive power. The offensive and defensive power is presented to us as a strong building, a fortress, a refuge, a fortification for the foundations. Old Rotherham says, out of the mouths of children and sucklings thou hast laid a foundation for strength and established a stronghold. Luther has observed in this passage, God makes fortifications out of the praise of babies and infants. When we are at our weakest, God can show himself strong. It is then that God's adversaries and foes are put to shame. We may look like a little flock of sheep or goats in the presence of great armies. God's chance to show himself strong. In the heavens above, God's divine name is whispered through his creation. And it is through these that he makes himself known. And even if his enemies do not acknowledge God's glory, the God of the universe shows his strength via the praise of babies and infants. Now, I tell you what, nothings, little ones, Yahweh has placed in the mouth of children the power of his opposition to his adversaries. I'll show you. I'm going to take these weak things and beat you. And how can that happen? He will do the work. These weak babies and infants become God's strong power. He has chosen what is foolish and the weak in the eyes of the world to put to shame the wise. It is by obscure and naturally feeble instruments that God makes his glories known in the earth. Children, babies. Listen, these weak ones are God's answer to his enemies. When the church seems not powerful at all, we're small in number, no one pays any attention, those are the ones he can use. We may think our praises are mere trifles and mean nothing, the hymns we sing. But in the hand of God, they are powerful fortresses for defense and even offense. In those great days, fortresses were offensive things, not just defensive things. You could say to your enemy, come on, give me your best shot, because you lived in this castle. Today, castles can just be bombed out by airplanes. But in those days, the enemy would wither and tire himself going against such a fortress. And finally, often they just go home. Now, this truth was lived out quite literally in the life of Jesus. But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that Jesus had done, and the children who were crying out in the temple, Hosanna to the Son of David, the chief priests and the scribes were indignant. And they said to Jesus, do you hear what these are saying? And Jesus said to them, have you ever read, out of the mouth of infants and nursing babes, thou hast prepared praise for thyself? Quoting this verse. Now, does Jesus necessarily want the praise of the chief priest? and scribes? That, by the way, is a rhetorical question. Does God want necessarily the praise of chief priests and scribes? No, is the answer. Here is a rhetorical question put to the scribes and Pharisees. Have you ever read? Then he quotes our text. Of course they had read it. But now this psalm was being lived out in their lives. They, as God's adversaries and foes, are being put to shame by children. This is to the glory of God. If men refuse to hear the voice of God around them as it is spoken to them through nature, God is not stymied and blunted. If men refuse to acknowledge God, then dumb stones would cry out. But isn't it sweet that God, out of the mouth of babes and infants, establishes strength, strong buildings and bulwarks and fortification? That, by the way, is another rhetorical question. Isn't it sweet that this is how God acts? What is the answer? Yes. Now, before we go on, I think many of you can have had this experience of when you're a child or younger, when you felt the touch of God pulling at your heart. I hope so. That's what we need to be praying for our kids. Lord, touch their heart. I can remember at the Bible Church in Wedgwood, Texas, went there for, what do they do? Bible school in the summer. And we all got together in there and we opened our hymnals. Those are the days they didn't show stuff up on the thing. We all read, we all sang Onward Christian Soldiers. And you may say that's kind of not a strong hymn, but it stirred my heart. And from that point on, there were little stirrings. I wish I'd kept a record of it, but that first time I remember. Isn't it sweet that we all sang that hymn that day? And God acted in power and spoke to a dumb little old kid. It's sweet. Now this brings us to our grand rhetorical question of our psalm today. And it is found in there, and I'm going to say it, quote it very simply. What is man? That's a pretty strong question. What is man? Well, it goes on, that thou dost take thought of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him. Now, the question could be answered in many ways. Libraries are full of books written on the subject, both theological and scientific. But the answer here to the question, what is man? The answer is immediately brought up to your mind when you ask the question, what is man that thou dost take thought of him? Well, he's nothing. Because the question is put forward in the light of the glory of God and the smallness of man. All this glory, if you've ever seen the Milky Way and its glory, you're dumbfounded. God whispers. But in light of that, what is man? This thought is echoed again in Psalm 144, just almost verbatim. What is man that thou dost take knowledge of him? Or the son of man that thou dost think of him? Man is like a mere breath. His days are like a passing shadow. Now listen to the poetic imagery here. Man is a mere breath. He's like a shadow. Breaths and shadows with no substance at all. In contrast to the maker of the universe and all that's in it, man is nothing. What is man that thou would think of him? Puny man may resist God, but the Lord laughs in response. Have you ever seen people make fun of God? God laughs. Men are literally nothing. They are breaths and shadows. I don't cast much of a shadow, but it's kind of over there. I'm even less than a shadow. I don't even have a shadow. But you could stomp on it. There's nothing there. Listen, men are like that. We're hardly breaths and shadows. Men are literally nothing in their rebellion against God. And their rebellion will come to nothing. Have you read the end of the book of the Bible? God wins. In fact, man's rebellion is, you might even say, it's a joke. It's humorous and it's futility. God laughs. If we had this more in our spirits, we would not respond in fear as we often do when we read the news or listen to the news. If we had this more in our spirit, we'd say, Here in our psalm, David is amazed that such a mighty God would even care to think about us. Thus his question, why would God even think about us? Why of all things would he turn aside and take note of man? As the Authorized Version says, is that thou visitest him. Isn't that King James have that? Anybody have King James? What is man that thou visit him? Let's go visit the Smith family. He does that with us. He visits us. We just pray for visitations. It is God's way to visit man. David has not just seen God's glory in the heavens, but in these dark hours, humility has been learned in these dark days, when God's enemies were present. Now, in the face of the glory of God, one old commentator says this, the most natural thought would be, frail, puny man is as nothing before God's glory. But this thought is passed over in order to celebrate with grateful emotion and the astonished adoration of God's divine love towards man, that he would take note of him and visit him. Amazement. God does take thought concerning human beings. He cares about mankind. Man is the special and favored object of God's eyes. Isn't that wonderful? He notes us. He watches us. But like we said before, he even visits us. He cares. Now, this is a real revelation What is man? And David speaks it. Man in his sinfulness may seem as less than nothing, yet he has been made in God's image, a little lower than God, it says in verse 5. Look at man's exaltation among all God's creation. God has made man in his own image. Now, what a value can be placed on man greater than that? Can you think of anything? Man is created as being made in the image of God, and therefore nearly, and I stress nearly, he is a divine being. There's something glorious about man. That's why this great trouble in the earth is a fight for men's souls. Now, in verses 6 through 9, man is a king, noted here, and not a king without a territory. The world around about is put into man's hands. Thou hast crowned man with glory and majesty. Thou dost make him ruler over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, sheep and oxen, also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, whatever pass through the seas, all have been given to man. Now, at this point, as David says these things, all thought of the night season is finished. He's not going back there. He's amazed that God has dealt thus with men. And I think he's thinking of himself as well. All thought about the night season and God's adversaries and God's enemies are just left behind. Oh Lord, verse 9, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. David is stunned and in amazement at God's dealings with men by making such provisions for him. This world is, if it weren't for sin, this would be, everything would be, this world is perfect for us. We would walk into this planet and say, oh, this is just how I would like it. When we made our little house over there on Lenana Street, Leba says, I don't want a kitchen where I'm off by myself and I can't see what's going on. She wanted the kitchen right in the middle of everything so she could be a part of it. It's just the way she likes it. This world is that way for us. He's given it to us. David is stunned and in amazement of God's dealing with mankind. And is giving this created world to him. Now, let's revisit the rhetorical question. What is man that God just think about us, that he even thinks about us? I remember once my parents came to me, a mom or my dad or somebody, and sat me down. And they said, Jeff, we've been talking about you. And at that, I was flabbergasted. I mean it. You were talking about me? I thought they didn't. I thought they never gave me the second thought. I was flabbergasted and waylaid. They were talking about me? And it just made me feel so warm. God thinks about us. If the thought of your parents thinking on you would bless you, God thinks on us and visits us. Now, apart from the significance of these verses, both doctrinally and theologically, it is amazing that God thinks about us. But can we not say in amazement, He thinks about me? You may think Christianity is just a religion. Some people go to church and do this or that. No, it is about God thinking about you. It's our dealings with the Creator of the heavens. It's a wonder and a surprise to David. He thinks on me. It's all too much to take in. If this were more in our spirits, we would not be so rattled in dark days. I'm an extremely fearful person. You may not know it, or you may. It doesn't matter. But He is thinking about me, and He is thinking about you before troubles even come to your door. Now, David is left in amazement in this psalm. And if David's eyes are dazzled by what he saw in the heavens, then we ought to look up too. And if you want to write over Psalm 8, amazement is the theme of Psalm 8. Amazement. He is amazed. Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. Okay. Thanks, Steve.